You're listening to the Hybrid Cloud Podcast, where the forecast here is always compelling as we discuss real-life challenges, successes, and stories from the journey to hybrid cloud with your host, Andre Tost.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Hybrid Cloud Podcast. Today's guest is Anand Jingran. Welcome, Anand. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, that's absolutely fantastic, Andre. Thank you very much for having me here and also for doing a great job on my name, right? It's not as easy as your name, Andre, but thank you very much.
All right. Anand, for everyone, he's obviously an IBM fellow. He is also, as of fairly recently, the CTO of all of IBM software. And obviously, that's something that we're going to go into a little deeper. But as always, maybe we should just start out with introductions, Anand. If you could take us through kind of your professional background, how you got to be to where you are today.
Awesome. So the number of lines on my resume, Andre, is not too many. I hang around in Silicon Valley and everybody kind of changes their jobs every 3 years or two or three years. But that's not me. So I got my PhD from Berkeley way, way, way back under a professor called Michael Stonebreaker, who some of your readers might know, in some ways kind of father of databases, though IBM Research may claim, correctly so, that they were fathers and mothers of databases. But Mike Stonebreaker was known for doing many things, but in particular also doing something called Ingress and Postgres. And Postgres as a database is still alive and is used now. So I got my PhD under Mike Stonebreaker, and then I joined IBM Research on the East Coast, and I helped IBM get into parallel databases and other things, kind of maintain my database skills. And around 2000, I moved to the West Coast and took over computer science of IBM's Almaden Research. So I ended up doing quite a few things across both the East Coast and West Coast, but primarily being kind of a database guy who kind of understands what it means to put stuff on disks and get stuff out of disks in some efficient fashion. And then I kind of moved to the product division. I was CTO for IBM's data division. So I basically ended up doing kind of database and database related stuff for about 27 years or so, 21 in IBM, 5 years in PhD, and a couple of years before that as my undergrad. And then I said, okay, that's enough. I can't be known just as a database person. And I said, look, there's more around IBM. IBM is not the end all be all of everything. And I sit in Silicon Valley. Therefore, I should actually try my hand at startup. I don't want to end up retiring and saying, shoot, I didn't try something. So I ended up joining a company called Apigee. I left IBM after 21 years at IBM. And it was an API management company, Andre. And in the world of APIs, there's no concept of disks. You bring stuff in, you respond, and you go back, right? And it was a very, very different world than the world of kind of thing. But I then got to know a bit of stateless processing, just like databases were.
I was actually going to mention that. Isn't the challenges also, you know, when we say things like cloud native computing and so forth, the challenges always begin when you add state to the problem, right? So it almost feels like when you live in a stateless world, isn't your life a whole lot easier?
No, so we database nerds would say your life is a whole lot easier. But the fact of the matter is there are challenges on both sides, right? The theory of stateless scaling is just the theory. Okay? The practice of stateless scaling still runs into a huge number of issues. So I have just actually come to appreciate kind of the stateless side. It's a different set of problems. I would not say that it's easier. Yes, my old database hat on would say, you folks ain't seen nothing. But the fact of the matter is that there are problems on both sides. Okay, so coming back to it, so I did Apigee, and then Apigee got acquired by Google. And at some point in time, I said, look, I don't want to go from one large company, IBM, to another large company called Google. And so we spun out and we did a company called StepZen. And then SlepZen finally got acquired into IBM a few months back. And that's how I ended up in IBM. And given the fact that I had done so many different things and in general, sometimes I at least talk sense, your general desire that, look, can Anand be involved in kind of broader software activities rather than just steps in the company that came. So that's my kind of long journey. But you're absolutely right that during this journey, I saw both the stateful and stateless processing. I saw a lot of on-premises in IBM, and I saw a lot of cloud and cloud deployments in both Apigee as well as Google and StepZen. So I kind of have a bit of kind of a hybrid mixture of, I've seen a few things, both in the concept of technical stuff, but also in things that can be done the IBM way and things that are done the Silicon Valley way. And I hope to bring kind of the best of that kind of hybrid knowledge and understanding to this current role at IBM.
Okay, so for those of the listeners who don't know, can you say a couple sentences about StepZen? Kind of what software is that?
So StepZen, by the way, the hardest thing in any startup is naming. Okay, it's not building technology. So separately, we can have a story on why StepZen. And the second hardest thing is pricing. Okay, but I'll put those two hard things aside. What StepZen is about is kind of an evolution of API story, which says that, look, yes, the world understands that APIs drive kind of connectivities. But the fact of the matter is that applications still have to string together a set of APIs and understand different protocols and formats. So there's a kind of a new API standard called GraphQL that's emerging that allows for kind of mixes kind of a query language into the world of APIs. And somebody can come in. So for example, Andre, if you're building an application and then let's say Mark comes in, and Andre might say that, okay, look, when Mark comes in, I want to greet Mark by name and show his latest orders and show what the delivery status is. So what Andre, you as building an application, needs to be able to connect to a CRM service, a database service, a DHL service, and everything else. And what GraphQL does is it allows you to make just one call and leave the job of connectivities and everything else to that kind of GraphQL service. So that's what we started to do. That's what we did. And the second thing that we firmly believed in is that something delivered as a service has just phenomenal efficiencies and economics compared to something delivered as a software. So what we decided to do was to build out kind of the best GraphQL service. And that's what we did. And that's how we ended up at IBM.
Okay, I have a couple of follow-up questions on that, but just to start with, so when you said you ended up at Google and you said you wanted to not end up with a large company again, so which was first? What, the idea to run your own startup or the technology that you thought was promising and then you said, maybe I need to run this on my own?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. It's almost always... And obviously, the kind of the desire of doing your own stuff almost always starts first. Not almost always, but at least it did. So what happens is that Apigee was a smallish company. It was a company of about 400 people when we went public and then finally when we got acquired by Google. And Google is an awesome big company, by the way. Just like IBM is. It's an awesome big company, but it's a big company. And in big companies, you are kind of given somewhat of swim lanes to say, look, this is what you do, right? And in a startup land, that's not the way it works. What you do is what needs to be done, not what you think your role is. And therefore, for me, it was very clear that ending up in a company where I'm being told this is what you do, okay, is not something that I want to do. And the question really was, therefore what? It was very clear to me that if I'm going to end up in another big company, then there's no other better big company that I know of than IBM, right? So I'm not going to go from there to some other big company because it's going to run into the kind of same sets of issues, right? But so the desire to kind of do something even smaller and do something that where we kind of set the controls of what the company are, okay, came first. And then obviously, in parallel, Sridhar, who was a co-founder with me, and Helen, who was a co-founder with me, we started to talk about what ideas and everything else. So in some ways, in this particular case, kind of the desire of doing something on my own probably came before the actual idea.
Okay, interesting. I wanted to touch back on how you described, you know, GraphQL, because I thought it was interesting, because maybe it somewhat reflects and I don't know if you would confirm that or decline, so to speak. It reflects a kind of a change in how we view query or access to data, in that it used to be a query was an extension of the database, right? You have a database, there's data in there. Obviously, it needs to be exposed in some form or shape, and that's where the query comes in. So the query engine also being kind of tightly coupled with the database itself. You described GraphQL as an extension of API, which again, fundamentally is a stateless thing, which can then plug into all kinds of backend data sources and gets mapped into connections of or whatever protocol these things speak. So kind of a transition from viewing data access and query from being tied to the data to more like decoupled from the data and being tied to an API.
I think you hit the nail on the head. You're 1,000% right. That's how. See, what happens is that the real problem to solve is not how the data gets unlogged. Yes, that's important. But the real problem to solve is that for every 10 people who know how to handle databases within a company, there are 1,000 people who know how to write applications and application programs in JavaScript and in whatever else their favorite language is going to be. So the problem really is, how do you kind of make them data aware, use data? And this same problem exists in the world of AI also, and hopefully we'll get a chance to touch on that in a few minutes. But really, you have to kind of come in from use down as opposed to data up. And when you kind of come in from a use down, what you really want to do is to say that, look, Andre as an application builder doesn't care jack about where the data is coming from. All he cares for is, give me the customer name, give me his or her orders, and give me the delivery status. Andre wants to be able to express his desire of what he wants from a consumption perspective. And that needs to map. So in some ways, you're absolutely right. It's not just about decoupling, but it's about shifting the frame from where the data is to where it needs to get consumed.
Okay. And if I spin that forward, and I guess I'm fast forwarding here a little bit into this whole new wave of, you know, generative AI and so forth, to then say what generative AI brings to us is the ability to interact with these systems in natural language, right? That's kind of one of the premises of what this does. And that extends into data access and data consumption by now being able to go even further and saying, instead of articulating a query, I just articulate a question in my language, in the way that I talk, and then using generative AI to again map that into something that can be run against the data source.
Hey, our audience won't see it, but the demo that I'm going to show on the keynote in Tech Exchange, which is exactly that. Somebody comes in and says, the context is the user is Andre.toast at IBM.com. How many orders does he have? And what are the tracking IDs of those orders? Okay. And internally, we use GenAI to convert this into a GraphQL query. And that GraphQL query itself then goes and assembles the data from a CRM system, a database system, and a kind of delivery subsystem and everything else. But the idea is to, exactly as you pointed out, to extend the consumption even further, okay, into kind of natural language consumptions. And that's exactly right. Because I think that the story for all technology, it's always mired into problems that the backend folks see and speak and worry about. But the story of all technology, including, for example, with this GenAI thing, is really how can it be pervasive with respect to all the people who don't care about the bits and bytes, okay, but just want to actually get something better out of it. And that has been a mental shift that has happened in my mind over the course of last 10 years as I kind of moved out from the gorp of engine room into the world of APIs, then into the world of GraphQL, and then into the world of GenAI now in my kind of new role. It's all about we kind of spend inordinate amount of time, is this model better and that model better, etc. It's all fine. In the end, none of that stuff matters unless and until it makes a difference for somebody up there. So that's why I'm trying to push, cajole IBM into kind of bringing that kind of top-down application-centric view, because that, in the end, that's what makes a difference.
Okay. If I just take a slight step back, though, I'd like to get your point of view on SQL specifically, because for a long, long time, obviously, when we said database in an IT context, that meant a relational database. And if you want to get data out of that database, you use SQL, right, on top of that. I feel like that then came a wave where all of a sudden relational databases were out of fashion and the so-called NoSQL databases were all the rage. And I've even heard customers of ours say, you know, nobody in their right mind doing an application will use a relational database anymore. So they kind of fell out of fashion. I feel, though, that it's seeing a comeback to some degree, and SQL as a language to query is also seeing a comeback. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely, man. Look, there's a time and place for everything. And kind of the NoSQL world came about because of two movements. One was, yes, it's true that there was a set of kind of document artifacts and kind of data artifacts that didn't exactly fit the relational model, right? So that was one of the problems that we were solving. So if you've got kind of text docs, what do you really do with it? You can't really force it into kind of relational constructs because that's kind of ugly as hell. But the second one was that, look, I really can't scale my relational worldview to be kind of geographically distributed. And it's true that kind of the relational deep consistency model kind of gets in the way. So kind of bringing both of these trends together started this kind of NoSQL construct. And it was the right, it was needed because at that time, the relational systems didn't quite capture the right thing. But then over time, two things happened, right? So what people realized is that the declarative power of SQL is just astounding. I'm just a huge believer in declarative stuff. Declarative stuff tells the system what it wants, not how you should do it. Okay? And what the mistake that some of the NoSQL guys did was they tried to kind of allow people to tell you how to be done. And people realized that SQL is really, really astounding. And the second thing that happened, Andre, during this time was that the database themselves became much better in kind of geographical distribution and consistency across it. And so the net of all of it is, you're absolutely right, that there has been a resurgence of, for that kind of extreme scale and document type, there's been a resurgence of relational database. And I've been kind of watching it for 40 years plus. And if you'd asked me 40 years back, would databases survive this long? Not just survive, thrive, I would have said, maybe not, okay? But 20 years back or 10 years back, I was absolutely convinced that databases are here to stay.
Okay. I want to get back to kind of what your current job is, right? So we've talked a lot about data, databases. That's, as you described, that was kind of your upbringing. Now in your new position in IBM, obviously you cover an extremely broad range of technologies, all the way from software managing buildings to machine learning, AI, middleware, and data still, and generative AI, of course, right? So how do you deal with that? How do you get a handle on all the different things and how they fit together so that you can kind of figure out how to set direction?
That's a great question. You get a handle on it by fundamentally believing that smart people are in charge of what they're doing. Okay? Because if you don't believe that, then there's kind of no future. Okay? So under that assumption, Andre, say, okay, great, great. This, assume for a minute that all leaders who are kind of driving stuff are smart and in charge. And you say, okay, what are kind of a couple of places where there's that kind of interstitial gap, okay, that is what's causing the problems. Not causing the problems, that's something where I can, for example, help. And so what I do is typically every month or so, I mean, in the job only for a month and a half anyway, kind of focus on what are kind of a couple of things where I feel that I can actually add value as opposed to everything else where I can have an opinion. And so the two things that I'm currently focused on, logically speaking, of course, is kind of getting a handle on Gen AI, and we'll kind of touch on that in a second. But the second one, I strongly believe, as I told you with respect to StepZen, is that I think that SaaS way of building software is very different than software way of building software. Okay? And you can kind of come to that same point, but from two different directions. Assume, for example, that software needs to be delivered both in kind of SaaS form factor as well as a software form factor. You can either take software and SaaSify it, or you can take SaaS and make it software. Okay? And the two worlds are very, very different. And what Sridhar and I are trying to do, just in that world, is to say that, look, there's an alternative way of getting to both sides. And one alternative is to start SaaS first. Okay? And so that's one place where I'm kind of putting some energy on and trying to get people to think about SaaS first as opposed to SaaS second. And of course, the first one that I talked about was really around Gen AI. So in the broad scope of things, those are the two places that kind of take up 80 to 90% of my energy.
Okay. And that actually gives me the opportunity to tie this conversation to the title of the podcast, Hybrid Cloud, right? So I think you've, to some degree, you've kind of answered it already, but how does Hybrid Cloud play into all of this?
Yes. So that's a great question. So one of the things that I'll just kind of go back, and by the way, in this, there are lots of places where I have opinions and views and kind of self-formed views. But kind of big shout out to my co-founder, Sridhar, and many other people at StepZen who kind of taught me how things can and should be done. And what we realized is this, that having one code line where all customers are, all developers, all customers are at the kind of the head of that line, means that a fix for one is a fix for all. Okay. And so what that does is it gets that kind of feature and function velocity focused on solving customer problems as opposed to solving deployment issues and patching and this and that and everything else. And what we realized was that in that model, you can actually do kind of multi-cloud deployments using exactly that same model. You've got one code line. You kind of spin it up and deploy it. In our case, we're deploying it on Google Cloud. You can deploy on Google Cloud US Central. You can deploy it in Google Cloud Zurich. And then some of our customers came and said they wanted deployed on the Azure on-premises stuff. We said, no problem. It's just yet another deployment of the same software. Etc. etc. And we realized that this model of SaaS first allows us to actually then deploy in kind of multiple places, up to and including kind of the VPCs and others, where we are managing the deployment, okay, and the customer is then bringing their APIs or bringing whatever else out there. Now, that model breaks, okay, when you want to kind of give a piece of software to the customer and say you deploy. Okay. We said, okay, now look, are we running at kind of the edge of that model, that SaaS model, which is extremely efficient? Our smartest brains are there in kind of building feature velocity and everything else, we can do it kind of multiple places. But does that model break when we get to software? And we realize that it doesn't. If we constrain kind of software deployment a bit and say thou shall not get whatever you want, thou shall get one of the stable releases in this code line. And the advantage of that stable release in the code line is that, for example, let's say that we release kind of twice a week. We get to observe what's really happening with that release for the next 2-3 weeks. And if we don't see too many bugs on that, if we see that this is relatively stable, we can take a cut of that. And now we can kind of package it. Everything is kind of Kubernetes, Red Hat, OpenShift, deployment artifacts. Anyway, we can take a cut at it and give it to the customer. And obviously, if there's a kind of bug and patch in it, we are not going to patch that stuff. The changes that the customer has to then move to kind of the next stable release that has that fix, okay, or the head where we were actually fixed it. So with that small twist, you can actually have a continuum where you get your best brains on working on features and functions and what really matters, and then taking kind of relatively stable versions of it and deploying it. Now, obviously, a lot of containers and Red Hat technology, et cetera, has actually helped us, but the thinking has to shift from we'll do whatever it'll take to satisfy and patch whatever the customer wants to know. Look, customers have to take kind of stable releases as they kind of go along. Okay. And that's kind of a shift that needs to happen for certain sets of products, especially products that are starting now. Okay. And that will then kind of bring kind of a delivery efficiency and a feature velocity for our customers. Because in the end, a delivery efficiency allows me to put most of my resources on features and functions and capabilities, as opposed to kind of worrying about patches and deployments and all that stuff. So the idea is that it's efficient for us and it's beneficial for our customers.
Okay, that makes sense. And I'm seeing that, I mean, as one example, our recent offering in generative AI that obviously came out as SaaS first. But then we do run into customers, obviously, in certain places of the globe and in certain regulated industries where they say, well, I cannot leave the boundaries of my country. And if you don't have a cloud center in my country, then I need to find alternative ways of running it, right? And so that always puts you back into this, well, then can you run it on your own, right?
Exactly. No, actually, I think it's absolutely fair for the customers to say that they want to run it on their own. And we have to enable that. But what I'm going to say is what we give the customers, okay, is not whatever random thing that they want, that patch and that release and that this and that, et cetera, et cetera. So as long as something can be constrained, you can maintain the efficiency of a SaaS delivery model and yet deliver software. That's the fundamental thing. It's not that, look, we shouldn't support software and force everybody into SaaS and VPCs. No. We should support software, but the software comes out of that SaaS line as opposed to SaaS coming out of the software line.
Okay. I'm looking at a little stopwatch here, and we're rapidly running out of time, but I don't want to let you go without asking what I usually ask as my last question, which is if you had to pick one project, activity, technology that you find extremely exciting at the moment, to the degree that you can share, in terms of, you know, what gets you up in the morning and you can't wait to get to work. Can you name an example of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's obvious that some of us old folks tend to be skeptical about, been there, done that, seen it, et cetera, et cetera. It's clear that Gen AI is kind of a quantum leap. By the way, crypto and blockchain never did that to me. Okay, never did that to me. And this may be just me, but it never did that to me. Okay, it's just kind of a quantum leap in kind of the capabilities. And what I see is that IBM has a unique, differentiated opportunity out there. And the opportunity really is to make it safe, stable, and usable by enterprises as companies like OpenAI and others focus on kind of the consumer side of the story. But just because the opportunity exists doesn't mean that we'll end up winning. And in order to kind of win on an opportunity that exists, a lot of things have to kind of go right. And that's why I'm just basically fundamentally focused on making sure that I try to kind of break some boundaries, say, no, look, this is not important. This is just table stakes. This is where we're going to actually differentiate and everything else. And at the same time, as you would guess, to me, not writing code, not touching, not feeling, not building artifacts, etc., is not something that makes me extremely comfortable. So in this new world, I'm just kind of continuously experimenting and doing stuff and deploying stuff and building APIs against it and testing it and everything else. And so it is a kind of combination of, look, I could play a role in making sure that IBM succeeds. And at the same time, kind of the technical chops in me don't get withered away into just kind of helping IBM with strategy. It is these two things that kind of make me wake up every day.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and I work in generative AI now, so that's very close to me. And one of the questions I'm asking myself is if it's going to go through the usual hype cycle, you know, where something gets overhyped and then a sense of realism sets in, and then we try to make it real, so to speak, right? And feel a bit like we're still kind of at the peak of the hype cycle at this point. And so the question is whether that valley of I don't know what it's called, you know, whether that downturn is still happening.
The trough of disillusionment, right?
Right.
So my view on this is actually relatively simple. Yes, there'll always be kind of trough of disillusionment because there'll be charlatans who will be over-promising and under-delivering. And obviously, kind of the societal impacts of this are also actually really, really deep. Right? The societal impacts of this are really, really deep. And we can't just say, okay, technology marches on without kind of considering and worrying about kind of the societal impacts and fake news and productivity gains versus job losses, right? All of those things have to be kind of taken into account. But my view in this is actually quite simple, that anything that we think about the impact of this, okay, we are undercounting it. Okay. Now as we know, or somebody had said it, future is, it's impossible to predict or whatever it is, especially about the future. I think it was either Niels Bohr or Yogi Berra. But I'm just very, very bullish on its impact. Obviously, it'll go through its series of things, okay, which I was not for kind of previous sets of hypes.
All right. So with that, we're going to wrap it up for today. So let me thank you. It was great to have you. Lots of great insights. Thanks for coming, Anand.
Hey, thank you so much, Andre.
All right. So with that, we'll close it out. Thank you all for listening and hope to see you soon again. Bye-bye.